So let's continue. I want to ask you more generally about the mortgage market, but since you were talking about Countrywide when we took the break and we're distinguishing it from the companies that did fail or did receive government assistance, do you think Countrywide could have survived if B of A didn't buy it?
I'd be speculating.
Were you folks ever contemplating filing bankruptcy?
No.
Do you know whether or not Bank of America ever went to the government and said...
Well, can we be clear for the record? You say contemplate. You mean retain, engage, and talk to lawyers? Or are you just talking about just thinking off the top of their head or... Just a discussion over a table.
Well, he answered the question, but let me try to make it clear. Did you, sir, ever think about Countrywide filing for bankruptcy? Did you ever have any discussions with anyone at the company about the possibility of Countrywide filing for bankruptcy?
No.
Okay. Did you ever retain legal counsel to look into the possibility of filing bankruptcy?
No.
Okay. Do you know if Bank of America ever asked the government for assistance for any reason related to its acquisition of Countrywide?
I'm not aware of what Bank of America did.
Okay. Did anyone at Bank of America, or strike that, did you ever have any discussions with anyone at Bank of America or otherwise where relating to whether or not they felt the value of the assets were less than what they initially thought when they purchased the company?
Say that again?
Sure. After Bank of America acquires the company, after the $2 billion initial equity investment and then the actual final purchase, I think, at the end of 2Q08, if I'm not mistaken, ever any discussions with anyone, let's first start within Bank of America, about, hey, the company's in worse condition than we thought, there's more losses, there's more embedded losses either in the assets of the company or otherwise?
I left the date of the acquisition, the date of sale, and never communicated with anybody about anything.
Okay. So going back now to the non-traditional mortgage market that we were talking about, and understanding before we took a break, you were saying, look, these types of loans always existed, whether they were FHA or VA loans, high loan-to-value loans, loan-to-value ratio loans, et cetera. Did you see... understanding they always existed, did you see an increase in the amount of these loans being made in the 1990s or 2000s as a percentage of overall originations, for example?
I think industry-wise, the advent of companies like New Century and AmeriQuest and Monolines was new to me. I think new to the industry. That was a change. And the first Franklin's.
How about securitizations?
Well, before we get there, I am going to get to securitization, but before we get there, I've seen a couple, I believe in the 2006 or 2007 earnings calls, a couple of times you referred to the smaller, quote-unquote, subprime lenders that came on the scene and talked about that they were perhaps not making or were not, you know, conducting themselves responsibly. And you had made comments, too, that, you know, lenders have a responsibility, you know, to make sure the loans they're putting borrowers in are loans that they can afford. Did you see any change in that regard? You know, lenders making loans that, at least in your opinion, were irresponsible loans that borrowers, you know, could not afford? And how did you see that change over time, if at all?
I'm going to step in here. You know, part of the trial proceedings in 3 weeks have to do with some of those transcripts on those comments about subprime. So I'll ask that you move on to something else.
Well, they're public statements. I mean, and I'm not asking him about. I guess I don't understand. I mean,
we're not going to address issues that are directly before the court in 19 days. We're happy for you to read all the pleadings and the like on the issues, but we're not going to do it today.
Okay. Irrespective of your comments during the earnings calls, did you feel that there was an increase by any lenders out there in loans being made that you know, borrowers could not afford?
I didn't know if any loans were being made that borrowers couldn't afford. I mean, that was a judgment I couldn't make because I was looking at the underwriting documentation that these other lenders had. I didn't have access to the database.
So were products you weren't making.
No, but he wasn't the question.
That's right.
The question was, can they afford it or not? I mean, that's that would be dictated by, you know, whatever is in the loan application and the documentation in the file itself.
Mm-hmm. Earlier today, you said that you Countrywide would look at four standards when making loans. Could the borrower have the willingness and ability to pay? Does the loan benefit the borrower? Is the loan saleable, and is it priced to risk? How would Countrywide determine whether or not the loan, whether the borrower was willing and able to pay, and whether or not the loan benefited the borrower?
That is also part of the trial in 19 days.
Are you directing him not to answer?
Yes, because of what we told you at the beginning of this. We're happy to have him answer after the trial. We're happy to have you read all pleadings on the trial. We'll be glad to give you all of the pleadings on the trial electronically, including there are thousands of pages that were filed last month with regard to summary judgment. But at this time, at this juncture, as we're preparing for trial, well, these are the very issues that are being tested in trial. We ask for the courtesy to let us try our case.
I believe me, I'm not trying to interfere with you folks trying your case. All I'm trying to do, which I think is very clear, is understand Mr. Mazzillo's opinions, given his 40, 50 years in the industry, about the non-traditional mortgage lending business and how that was changing over time. One of those areas that I've been asked, that I'm trying to ask about now, is what he saw, if anything, in terms of those types of loans being made to borrowers and whether or not those were, you know, responsible loans or loans that he thought or didn't think, you know, borrowers had the ability to repay. If you're telling him not to answer those questions, then we'll deal with that later, and he won't answer those questions, assuming he's going to...
Fair. He's asked, and he's answered that he has no idea about the other underwriters, about the other competitors, because he doesn't see their loan files.
Well, yes, he's answered that, and when I've asked two other questions, you've jumped in and said he's not going to answer that. That's fine if Mr. Mazzillo is going to...
focused on Countrywide's portfolio. That is the focus of the trial in 19 days.
Look, I understand you have a trial in 19 days. I understand. I'm just saying that I need to know, one, if you're instructing him not to answer, and two, if he's going to do that.
I'm instructing him not to answer questions at this time which are material to the SEC trial in 19 days, which you're well aware of. We've articulated to you the limits of today's interview.
Well, you've articulated to me today.
We're volunteering all information that you want that you can get in the next 19 days from the written pleadings. Mm-hmm. Which are voluminous, and if you feel at the conclusion, you're welcome to attend the trial, and if you feel that at the conclusion of the trial you still haven't gotten your answers, we will also submit to another interview.
I appreciate that. I just want the record to be clear that at least I did not hear about limits on what questions would be answered until today.
Would you not have come today, sir? Had you heard that?
No, I probably would have come, but we would have had discussions about what not would be.
You mean you want discovery about his trial?
No, I don't want discovery on his trial. I want my answers
tomorrow. Your tape can be subpoenaed tomorrow, Chris? Yes.
Yes.
We're not trying to obstruct anything. He's talked freely for an hour and 15 minutes already, and he's not going to talk freely for another hour and 15 minutes. But I don't want him, out of respect to the court and to the trial proceedings in 19 days, to have examinations of questions which can be subpoenaed by other parties between now and the 19th that are directly material to the case. This is not a civil discovery.
That's exactly.
Yeah.
It's not civil discovery.
About policy and practice in the industry and perceptions about what might have happened and corrections and remedies for the future, that's great.
Well, I think that's exactly what I was just asking.
Okay, as long as we stay away from the Countrywide portfolio.
Why don't you put your question in that mode, and let's see where we are with it.
Let's try this. you had mentioned previous to this that the advent of companies like New Century, First Franklin, and others was something that was new to you. How were those companies, what were those companies doing differently from Countrywide, for example? What was new that you, could you expand upon that, please?
Well, they were monoline by their own definition. They only focused on subprime. And these were public company. Well, AmeriQuest wasn't, but New Century was. With a lot of capital. It was, up to that point, it was a cottage industry, hard money lending. It was not major enterprises. These were big operations dedicated themselves solely to the mile line. It was different. Countrywide, only 10% of our business was subprime. And most of, whether it be Bank of America or Wells Fargo, or they had basically prime lenders with subprime as, you know, part of their social mandate and other types of business. But these were big enterprises, a lot of power.
And how did that impact the market?
I don't know what you had to find the market.
How did that impact the mortgage origination market, and in particular the non-traditional mortgage origination market?
Well, the non-conforming, let's use that,
sure,
that terminology, non-conforming market, which would not be agency eligible, grew substantially, and I think what permitted that to grow was the securitization, the ability to securitize that product, and the ability to get ratings from the rating agencies, and the ability to slice and dice the security, you know, to get the appropriate ratings. All of that was relatively new to the business, and there were residuals created, that sort of thing. It was all new. And became a major force in, you know, in mortgage lending.
Did you see looser underwriting standards from the subprime monolines? Same, stronger. How did that impact underwriting standards in the industry overall, if at all?
I think what impacted the underwriting standards more than anything was the government mandates and the expanded guidelines set forth by Fannie and Freddie. I mean, that was the major factor, at least in country-wise world.
And how can you explain how the government mandates impacted underwriting standards in the industry overall, and Countrywide in particular?
Well, because the effort on the part of the government to, which, you know, I personally supported, is to try to provide a greater opportunity to potential home buyers to owning a home, because the foundation of Countrywide was based upon three platforms. One was to, this is back in 69, to lower, because then we were an FHA VA lender, so that's the arena we dealt in, to lower the barriers of entry for the American home buyer, to lower the cost of financing for the home buyer, and we did that through technology efficiency, and to educate the buyer as to their rights and responsibilities of owning a home, which included, by the way, we counseled a little under 100,000 families as to how to go about building the credit to get a home. They had a desire for home ownership, but didn't, and we had them at home. We had home ownership fairs, some of them with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, at least with Fannie Mae. Where we put them on the road to home ownership. It was through our housing, we established a program called House America. It was through that program that we directed our efforts to the mandates of the government, because we wanted to make sure that we were paying proper attention to that mandate. And it was hard to do that in an organization as large as we had, and so we had to have a focus. And the focus was to create this other entity called House America.
Did I know Countrywide both under, you know, made loans that it portfolioed and loans that it sold into the secondary market? Were there different underwriting standards for those two types of loans?
Which loans? I'm sorry.
What loans that you're going to keep on the books and loans that get sold into the secondary market?
Okay. Only, we had Clues, which handled all loans. So they had to go through our automated underwriting system. Clues was an underwriting system that we developed. It was the first automated underwriting system created in the country before Fannie Mae, before any of the proprietary system. So all of our loans went through that same underwriting system. The only difference would be that when we had the bank regulators placed limits on FICO scores on loans in the bank, and I believe it was in the bank at the under 660, I believe. And so anything that was below 660 were good loans, but they were below. They didn't meet the mandate of the regulator, the OCC, that we put them in the, we sold them in the secondary market, either Fannie Mae or securitized it.
Just, Angela, when you say the only thing, you mean the only thing is sort of as you sit here today that you could think of.
And I think of, yeah.
You may recall back in, I want to say, 2008, there was an article in the New York Times about a purported meeting between you and Mr. Mudd from Fannie where the comments were, in effect, actually, I'm sorry, the article in 2008, the meeting back in, I think, 05, where, and out here, where the message was sent, essentially, look, Fannie, you need to start buying more of our non-traditional mortgage loan product, or we're not going to keep selling you the prime product. We'll be selling it to the street instead. Any accuracy to that article? Actually, do you remember the article?
No, I don't read the New York Times.
Okay. And I'm sorry, I think I talked over your answer. And any accuracy to the article?
No recall. Okay.
Explain to me generally, if at all, how securitization did impact the non-traditional mortgage loan market. And in particular, what I'd also like you to address, if you can, is how did to whom Countrywide sold its loans to change in the 90s or 2000s, meaning the street or the GSEs?
So that's two questions. Right, two questions.
He just wants, what he wants is history, kind of the secondary market developments. That'll cover the second. Just generally, how did the industry change?
Securitization generally for the industry. Start there.
Securitization was a dramatic change in the industry. For several reasons. I want to take you back to a time when, prior to securitization, loans were sold to savings banks. These are FHA loans, VA loans. Because Ginnie Mae was the inventor of the securitization process. If the loans were in Florida or California or Arizona, the board of the bank would insist on coming out and looking at these houses in the wintertime. That's the way I'd have to make dry runs to make sure we didn't make any mistakes. Got a limo, put them all in, pile all of them in, put them up in hotels, and those loans were then sent to attorneys, Calderwalder, Wickersham, and Taft, as I recall, to review. These are government guaranteed loans. The costs were astronomical. when convention time came, you had a big suite for these bankers to entertain them in, hoping that you can get a commitment from them for the year to buy your FHA and VA loans. Very expensive. Very awkward. Very cumbersome. And very bad for homeowners. When securitization came along, it was a paradigm shift overnight. These boards of directors of these savings banks were out of business as it related to coming seeing homes. Can't do that anymore. So we could save all that money and spend our time trying to be more efficient for the home buyer to lower the cost of homeownership. So securitization was to the mortgage business as the wheel was to the civilization. It changed everything. Initially,
are you talking about Fannie and Freddie in that, or
not yet?
No, it was Ginnie Mae. Because in the Ginnies, you can only have the Ginnie ones and twos could only have FHA and VA loans in them. The Ginnie ones, I think, were only mobile home FHA mobile home loans. So that was it pierced through all of it, made it all the mortgage brokers who dealt with these banks, exclusive to these banks, that deal through them and pay them in order to get to the bank to sell to them, all gone. So securitization had that profound effect on the industry. It really was a great thing for the industry and created the kind of liquidity that we didn't have. So for example, in 1966, when disintermediation took place and the savings banks, who were the providers buying these loans, no longer had disintermediation because people took all the deposits out and put them in money market funds. That was the end of Reg Q. And so the savings banks no longer had the advantage they had over the commercial banks, the 25 basis points advantage in providing a higher interest rate to the depositors. All the money flowed out overnight, and the banks were left with 30-year loans fixed at a certain interest rate, and no deposits with interest rates rising. In 66, the entire market shut down. There was no securitization, there was no place to sell loans, and that's when Fannie Mae came out and bought every single FHA and VA loan in the country, originated with a $15,000 loan limit. And that was okay for the rest of the country, except for California had a $21,000 average loan. The average loan in the country was $12,000, so it was okay. California was done. It was over. Created a major crisis here in California. That doesn't happen with securitization, because these bonds are sold all over the world, and so you're talking to a much wider audience, and it's not limited to what's happening in the United States. So very, very profound, very important, and hopefully one day it'll return, where you have conventional. You know, right now the only securitization that is going on, to my knowledge, is the Fannie, Freddie, and Ginnie securities. But if you're going to have housing is very important to the economy, in my opinion, much more powerful than economists acknowledge in terms of its relationship to GNP. It is a powerful force in our economy because it's not only the house, it's the lumber, it's the plumbing, it's the carpeting, it's the appliances, it's a lot of things, jobs. And unless we get housing going again, I think it's going to be very hard to get this economy going again. And that's why hopefully this will have, you know, securitization on that, which you called an untraditional and unconforming, come back in some form.
So when you talk about securitization having this dramatic change, what time frame are you talking about?
Well, I think Ginnie Mae had the first security. I think we did the first Ginnie Mae security, I think it was 1969, 70, somewhere around there. 70, soon after we were born.
How about, tell us, if you can, differences between, you know, the rise of securitization and, you know, for loans sold to the GSEs and, you know, secondary market securitization, the street. and what impact that had on the mortgage market, if any, and when?
Well, you know, Countrywide is a public company, and we our focus had to be our shareholders, and made sure that we were being efficient and not only pricing the risk, but making sure when we sold into the marketplace, we were selling into the selling into the market that provided the greatest profit opportunity for us. So it would change. I mean, Fannie Mae would, on certain products that they wanted that fulfilled their particular goal and mandate, they would pay up for it, or Freddie Mac would, or the secondary market might. You know, so it's always shifting, you know, back and forth. At some point, the securitization market got very efficient, extremely efficient for a period of time. It was very difficult for the traditional, like Fannie and Freddie, to compete. Part of the problem, I think, as I reflect on it, was not an underwriting issue or price issue. It was the problem that things were changing so rapidly that Fannie and Freddie had to make major technological changes to deal with the product changes. Because it's just not a matter of them taking a file and buying a loan. They had to make sure that it met their guidelines, and it met their ability to securitize on their end, and whether it made sense for their balance sheet. And in order to do that, they had to make major programmatic changes, technological changes, and that takes time. Particularly at that time they were fairly large. I think Fannie Mae had about 4,000 employees. Freddie Mac had about the same, and they got a little behind. The securitization market was much more technologically efficient than anybody, including us, and we were pretty good. They were fast in adapting to changes in the product line. And Fannie and Freddie, for a while, struggled with that. So we had to make it say, look, we're going to sell in the secondary market. As we were a mortgage banker, we need a secondary market. Which is the most efficient execution for us? And that's what dictate where it went.
But did you see over time in the 90s and 2000s and any change in generally the market where the loans were being sold to? I mean, was there a shift from the street to the GSEs or vice versa?
I think I can't remember back. I'm 72 years old. I can't remember back then in the 1990s. But I think it shifted, but there was, you know, back and forth depending upon pricing and depending upon product. But there's no question that securitization market was powerful, and I think I'm not sure of this, but I think if you took the whole body of loans originated in each of those years, I would guess that the majority would be sold through securitization versus the GSEs. I think, mm-hmm. But I don't know.
Right, and I will tell you that at least we have seen I think they're low. I mean, Fannie's share of the market declined substantially. And like by 03, 04, they were very low compared to the street. And then, you know, they started to ratchet back up a little. And it looks like because they started to buy certain types of loans that they weren't buying before. Does that jog memory bells? Is that consistent with your recollection?
Well, I mean, you have the data, so I just rely upon what you said. You know, it is what it was. I mean, we didn't have any control of the forces that were driving the business. We just had to react to them, mm-hmm. to those forces.
When you, in terms of the increase in securitization by the street, and that being another place for Countrywide and other mortgage originators to sell their product to, what impact did you see that have, if any, on underwriting standards?
I didn't, in terms of our standards remained unchanged. And you'd have to speak to, you know, Wells Fargo or Bank of America or, you know, the major players at the time and see what they did. I don't know. But our standards didn't change. Were guidelines expanded because of the mandates that were out there for a period of time they expanded? Yeah, they were. But the bottom line was, do they have the ability to repay? Because if you went back, because the guidelines didn't work. They didn't work. If you end up rejecting four times the number of African Americans and Hispanics versus whites, it's not working. It needs to be fixed, unless you're a believer in inequality. And so the government addressed that, tried to address that through their auspices of Fannie, Freddie, and FHA, and the industry tried to address that issue. So guidelines were expanded to meet those mandates, and that disparity that existed, that was discovered, I mean, it was nobody really ever collected the data before. Mm-hmm. It was the Federal Reserve of Boston that collected that data. I don't know why they were the ones assigned to it, but then, and it had been, I'm not sure when the Homeowner Disclosure Act passed, but I think it was in the 80s. It wasn't until 1992 that suddenly this thing comes out. So they had to be expanded.
So understanding that expanded guidelines by Fannie and Freddie resulting in, you know, different underwriting standards and the types of loans being sold to the GSEs, is that accurate?
No.
Okay.
I'm going to have to, and I think just so we don't keep talking at odds with each other over something, he's told you that the standards, and as he's comfortable with that word and those terms and its meanings, that his standards, what he wanted at his company, didn't change. Guidelines, products, those things expanded. And just you jumped in, and that question, why I interrupted you, is you jump back and forth, and that's going to just yield the same answer. And I think what you're trying to talk about now are products and guidelines and the growth of that part of the industry.
Right. So let me try it this way. Did you see that the rise of private securitization, not the GSEs, but of the street securitizing loan product, did you see that have any impact on the kinds of loans that were being originated in the industry?
I'm not sure how to answer that, because it's sort of, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg? I'm trying to figure that out. You know, answer correct, I really don't know. I really don't know, you know, what, you know, when the guidelines were expanded, whether or not the secondary market reacted to it, and therefore these structured financings were done to accommodate that, or whether or not the securitization market developed separate guidelines that somehow infiltrated its way into the primary market. I don't know the answer to that.
And just so the record's clear, when you talk about the guidelines, you're talking about the HUD affordable housing goal guidelines for the GSEs. Is that accurate?
No. Talk about overall guidelines.
Okay. Guidelines other than GSE guidelines? Okay. That explains it. Okay. Was there a difference between the types of loans that could be sold to the GSEs versus the types of loans that could be sold to the street, and in particular in terms of, you know, the non-traditional mortgage product that I've been asking you about? One of the things we're trying to figure out is if, you know, for example, could you sell a 100% combined loan-to-value ratio loan with a DTI over 50 to the street, but it would be something that Fannie and Freddie wouldn't be willing to take? I mean, was there anything like that going on in the 90s or 2000s?
I'm not intimate, frankly, with Fannie Mae's guidelines. I was CEO of a company, and I had people who did that. So I don't know, because Fannie Mae had a lot of different products, and I'm not sure whether or not they had 100% LTV or CLTV. I'm not certain of that. So I think that I just don't know.
And understanding you don't know the specifics of the Fannie and Freddie guidelines, just generally, do you have any recollection of whether, you know, there were types of loans that you could sell to the street that you couldn't sell to the GSEs?
I think there were.
Okay. And was it a help us understand whether this was a big part, whether there was a big difference, whether it was or not?
Not for countrywide. I mean, okay, only 10% of our loans were in what you're calling non-traditional. But probably for the industry, you know, cumulatively, you know, it was meaningful. For example, I think for a period of time, there was 125% LTV. I don't know how long that lasted. I don't remember. It didn't have a long life, but I don't believe Fannie or Freddie would have purchased that loan. Mm-hmm. But that product was somehow bifurcated into 25 and 100 and two different security. I don't know. You know, that's not familiar with that. But it wasn't a long-lived product, at least a country where it was a long-lived.
He may be asking even more broadly that just non-conforming, even jumbos, for example.
Well, that
GSEs would never have bought. Well, right. But his question right. was so broad, I'm yeah. not sure that
right. I mean, obviously, you know
the
that
right
they had loan limits. Mm-hmm. So right. these were very high FICO loans. Obviously, would have fit all the characteristics of a Fannie Freddie loan and a beyond. But the loan amount was non-conforming. So that's really what that's why securitization made a big difference, because there were no loan limits. And it so permitted areas like in high cost areas, be it Alaska, Hawaii, California, that sort of thing, to have more liquidity in the housing market than it did under the FHA, Fannie, Freddie regime.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What other impacts, if any, did you see from the increase in private securitizations? Again, on the mortgage origination market.
I think aside from primarily liquidity. And the ability to have more flexibility in loan amounts would be my overall response to that question.
Do you have any opinion about whether or not it resulted in riskier loans being made?
That's a very broad question. When you talk about risk, you can probably you know the fact alone, one loan is riskier than another is one factor. Does a riskier loan make it a non-quality loan? No. As long as you priced it properly to risk, you're servicing it properly, which is a big factor in how that loan is serviced. I would say that. The lower you, the not the non-traditional, but the lower you went down on the income and credit scale, you had higher risk. Under most circumstances, you know, just never know, but you had higher risk.
Let me that is a fairly broad term. Let me try to use your term of, you know, it may be a risky loan, but let's use your term of not a good quality loan or a non-quality loan. Did you see any impact on that from the rise of private securitizations?
Well, I think this is an area. I'm not going to stop the question. I think this is getting pretty close to some of the things in our case, and caution is going to be. Just go a little slow,
sure.
and Angelo, I think probably that question was, maybe you'll expand, but mm-hmm. part, I think your question calls for a yes, no, or you don't know answer.
Let me try to explain, and maybe that'll make it easier. You know, as I think is, I mean, I've been too clear, and maybe my questions have been somewhat butchered, but we are looking at growth in non-traditional mortgage loan product over time. We are looking at the growth of securitization over time, whether it's growth through the GSEs or whether it's growth through the street, and just trying to understand from folks that were working in the industry whether they saw any impact from that. That's why I'm asking you to try to distinguish between the street and the GSEs. That's why I'm asking you if you saw an increase or a change or an impact on originations in terms of risky loans or non-quality loans. That's all I'm getting at, is trying to get, you know, okay. your insight from being in the industry
about what
the impact was, if anything.
And I thought that the questions were of that vein. That's why it wasn't. I didn't see them as cutting into the lawsuit per se. Angela, I think what the broad question is did the growth of private securitization, the availability of that liquidity industry-wide, lead to some loans getting made that otherwise wouldn't have been available or made if you had if the industry had to live within the government GSE guidelines? I think that's your question. Without all the labels and everything else.
I don't know the answer to that.
putting aside size.
Yeah,
right.
I remember that about a lot of things, and I was focused on Countrywide.
Mm-hmm. Putting aside, well, that's why I said putting aside the size of the loan, obviously.
I don't think it's a question that I can, it's a very complex question. I don't, you know, the way I understand it, it's very, I don't know. I don't know what would have happened. You know, because it's really under the, Chris, it's under the, you know, under the guise of the theory of indeterminability. You just don't know. You know, you don't know if you did one thing, you know, what else would have happened. Because it's a very dynamic environment we're in. So I just don't know. Because things just don't stay static in any industry. You know, they're changing all the time. And I don't know what would have come in its place. Because a lot of loans were sold that were non-traditional, were sold without securitization to companies that were formed simply to take advantage of a product that they thought was going to provide a high return to them.
Mm-hmm. What did you see, if anything, or could you comment on changes in underwriting standards in the 90s and 2000s, and how did they change, if at all, during that 20-year time frame?
Our standards didn't change, so I can't answer for anybody else's standards. You've got to distinguish between what the standards of a company are versus its guidelines. They're two separate issues versus product. They're three distinct issues. So 327 is a product, right? What's the guidelines for that product? And since, you know, Countrywide had 188 different variations of the theme, you know, the guidelines differed for each of those. So I think what securitization permitted was expansion of product, which accommodated more people. People were not forced into the same box. And the guidelines, as I explained before, were expanded primarily to accommodate the mandates and the valid, important mandates of Congress, of two presidents, and the GSEs.
So then what kind of changes did you see in product over time in the 90s and the 2000s? And specifically, did what kind of changes did you see in terms of, I'll use my broad word of risky product, understanding it as a broad term?
Well, you know, I don't want to adopt your term, because I think that you're obviously come here under the guise of what caused the crisis, and you're focusing on Countrywide. Countrywide only had 15% of the business in the country, so obviously there's something else going on here. So I'm not adopting your risky. Loans are loans. Mm-hmm. There's degrees of risk in every single loan.
Well, why don't you start with just your first question, which I think was before you asked them. You just asked what products did you see change.
Right. What kind of new products? What kind of product changes did you see over the 90s and 2000s?
There were many. Really too numerous to mention. I mean, the more classical products were what they call bullets, 15-year bullets, 10-year bullets, the 3, 5, 7, 10 ARMs. If you go back a little further, we saw big changes with Fannie Mae product, the 245s, the two guns, and when Fannie Mae had their block of granite. We had
was that an offensive lineman or a prime?
No, a block of granite. They had a block of granite. It was considered there. They had a serious problem with the balance sheet. They had all these 30-year fixed rate loans on the balance sheet with no funding. But it was primarily in the variable rate category that I'd more variations off a theme. As I mentioned, it was a very small product, but we saw 125%. That's one I never could understand, but there was always justification for it. Home equity loans, the growth of home equity loans, primarily by banks that wanted that loan in their portfolio because it was a good asset liability match. You were a supervisor for a bank?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so you know that, you know, I'm not getting loans because of the way these interest rates move. It's a theoretically a great asset for the liabilities of a bank. Trying to think of more, the pay option obviously has got a lot of publicity, but that was around for 25, 30 years, but not securitized. That was on a balance sheet of banks, Downey, and I think the big one was
World
Savings. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know who invented that product, but that was around for a long time. But was able to be securitized, you know, so you didn't have, you know, the limitation of your balance sheet to originate those loans. Subprime, what is commonly known as subprime, became more of a mainline product, at least in Countrywide's experience. What we found in our experience in a company we formed called Full Spectrum, that many of the people that came through Full Spectrum subprime were really prime borrowers, didn't know it. And so they were shifted over to Countrywide to be processed as a prime borrower. The second thing we found is that with a small incentive, and these could all be securitized, it's on the secondary market, if they made their payments every month on time for a year, we would refinance them as a prime borrower. So it was really you know, we had, through securitization, a lot of flexibility because there was no prepayment on these things. We refinance and pay it off, create another security. So where there wasn't prepayment penalty, we gave a borrower an option. Look, if you want a lower rate, you pay a prepayment penalty. You don't want a lower rate, you pay a higher rate. You'll have no prepayment penalty, as I remember. So securitization created great liquidity and flexibility in the marketplace.
So we've been talking about broadly today about changes in the mortgage origination market over time, and you've talked about the Boston Federal Reserve study in 1992 and that leading to changing guidelines and efforts by the government to end discrimination. We've talked about the advent of the Fair Isaacs FICO score coming on the scene, and now we've been talking about securitization and how that provided more liquidity and flexibility to the mortgage market. What other than those three major developments, I think, could you tell us about that you saw having an impact on the mortgage origination market?
The only thing that comes to mind, Chris, is that in the more recent years, the OCC, the FDIC, the OTS, the Fed, you coming up with these joint agency guidelines, was a major change, because there wasn't these rigid, and I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, but there wasn't, you know, these clear lines drawn around how a loan is to be originated. You know, for example, it was always believed that if you have an appraiser appraise a property, you want the appraiser to be intimately familiar with the community, because each of these communities are distinguished by school systems and by safety, and by that was out the window. That was a fundamental change. You had to use a Rolodex, and you could take an appraiser from Covina and send him into Beverly Hills to appraise a house, and whether or not that appraiser could pick up on all of the differences between Covina and Beverly Hills, you know, it's questionable, and could impact values. But other than that, I think you hit upon it. I think it was the mandates, securitization, and FICO scores. You know, were major, not in that order necessarily, but had a major impact on, because I think about the discussions, the speeches, the arguments that took place were fundamentally around those issues.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, when you talk about the regulatory agencies coming out with the non-traditional mortgage guidance, I think subsequently it was specifically subprime guidance, that as you mentioned earlier, had a fairly large impact on demand because people couldn't qualify for these loans anymore.
Right. I think so. It seems to me. Because it's too coincidental that these come out and bangle. Mm-hmm. The demand goes down and, you know, we got this big flood of houses on the market. And mm-hmm. Sales of existing and new home sales go down dramatically. I think it did. I mean, it did. You know, again, it's a chicken and egg thing. I don't know of some other factors that were stirring around before that. I'm not sure.
And my question is, do you think those, what I'll term at least, tougher underwriting standards should have been in place earlier?
That's second-guessing the regulators. I think the regulators were in a tough spot. It was hard to see this coming. I mean, when you have the chairman of the Fed saying everything is great, no problem with the economy, no problem with, and you have the Congress and the regulator for the GSE saying everything's fine, they're well capitalized, no problems. This was hard to see. Mm-hmm. I think the regulators did the best they could. You know, they were up against a lot of opposition, but they stood their ground. And to say they should have done it earlier, you know, that's be second guessing on my part, and I don't do that.
Okay. And my question really wasn't should the regulators have imposed those standards earlier, but just within the industry overall, should underwriting standards have been more in line with the guidelines that were set forth by the regulators at an earlier time?
Chris, the one thing I want you to take away from this is that I don't believe it was the underwriting standards that caused this. I believe it was the collapse in real estate values that caused this. If real estate values had not collapsed, you would not be sitting here today.
So, for example, I mean, do you believe, I know you've said today that, look, you know, low down payment, no down payment, you know, loans have been out there for years and have performed fine. But is it, do you believe that there was an increased amount of low down payment or no down payment loans or an increased amount of just, you know, the multiple risk layering that at least we have seen from looking at the industry overall? It may be a low down payment loan back in the 60s and 70s, but the DTI was still 20% to 30%, and the, you know, borrowers, you know, was in the job for 5 years or whatever. Whereas, you know, perhaps later on we started to see, well, it's a lower no down payment loan, but the DTI is much higher, the FICO score is lower. I will tell you that we have seen, at least in a lot of originators and in the GSEs, what at least appears to be an increase in, you know, the overall risk profile of the loans because of the multiple risk layers. Do you have any opinion on that, and did you see any difference in that over time in the industry?
Can you explain multiple risk layers, what you're talking about?
Sure. So I'm talking about the various parts of the loan, the loan-to-value ratio, the debt-to-income ratio, where the property is, the borrower's income, the borrower's, whether it's owner-occupied, you know, all of the various things that a traditional underwriter would look at, you know, in terms of making those, looking at the four things that you talked about earlier today.
Plus the product type that the loan would be allowed to deferral of principal, yeah, whether it's an interest-only or payment option arm, mm-hmm, and say add in an investor property versus an owner-occupied.
Yeah.
So that's a risk layering feature.
Let me respond. Yeah, I get it. A couple of ways. One is I understand what your expressed mission is, and I think it's good for objective people, unbiased people, to look when a crisis occurs, what caused it, you know, what the cause was, and I'm a supporter of that. On the other hand, I'm not an advocate of going back to a system that created the kind of disparity that we saw in 1992. And what is the answer to a system that we had in 1992 and prior, and a system we had in 2007 that sort of is a middle ground that, you know, sort of takes care of the social issues, takes care of the risk profiles, and the, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I think that thoughtful people people who are constructive, trying to find a solution rather than a culprit, could come up with that answer. I think there's enough intellectual assets in this country, in the area that we're talking about, that if done, as I said, in an objective way, in a constructive way, could come up with the answer. I think that, you know, in a system that we have, in a capitalistic system, the system tends to go from one extreme to another. And it's trying to find that middle ground, you know, that works for everybody, investors and the government and taxpayers and the home buyers and society, you know, really, what the government's supposed to be serving, the people. It works for everybody. And I think there's an answer to that. But it requires a very special people that to come together to find the answers to that.
Mm-hmm. Were you finished? Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier today that, you know, it's one thing for me to take away, that you know, the biggest issue, or that none of this would have happened if it wasn't for the collapse in home prices, or words to that effect.
Do you agree with that?
I agree with a big part of it. I don't know enough yet to know, and this is what I'm getting to, other than the collapse in home prices, what, in your opinion, if anything, were the other drivers of the collapse of first the origination market and really just causes of the financial crisis overall? What are your opinions on that?
I've had to think a lot about it because, as I said, Dave Love and myself spent our lives building Countrywide, and it was our child. And it was dear to us as our children were. And to see, you know, what happened, you begin to question what, you know, what did happen, because it happened suddenly, literally overnight, over a weekend. As it has been playing books written by Bear Stearns, like, it's over a weekend, you had no idea. One day we're viable, overcapitalized, buying back stock because we have too much capital, to one day where we have no liquidity, where capital didn't mean anything. It didn't matter how much capital you have. Capital is meaningless. Not totally meaningless, but it's not as meaningful. Liquidity is the oxygen by which financial institutions live up, and not capital. Capital is just a discipline, in my opinion. I think, you know, this seems to be an oversimplification, but I think it was like the, it was 1807, when the panic. It was a panic. And because you say, well, what caused it? And when you can't find, I can't find a cause for it. As to why all of the banks, all of the commercial paper buyers, all of the medium-term note buyers, all of the repo lines, all different constituents, all financial, stop overnight. Because nobody wants to be the last one out the door in a fire. And it's one of the human frailties, you know, that it's a herd mentality, and let's get out, because I don't think there was any logic to it. The numbers didn't dictate that. The capital in these institutions didn't dictate that. Maybe in some cases you had some of the Wall Street firms that were not banks over-leveraged, you know, 30 times whatever the numbers were, but, you know, you take, you know, kind of like Countrywide, we were never over 7 times leveraged, because we were limited to 3 times on our servicing portfolio by rating agencies. And most of the banks were not over-leveraged. But the big banks certainly were, in my opinion. But it was just a panic, and it just made us, and then the panic ended. And this happened in, I think, August of 2007. It was just like overnight, and then by September, things started to ease again. So, well, okay, it was just a blip. And then it started again. And when it started again the second time, it was irretrievable. Why? You know, why did it come back? Why did it come back? I don't know. I don't think anybody knows. I think anybody knows.
So, in terms of looking at Countrywide, when you look back, what are the lessons learned or the mistakes made in terms of Countrywide?
We worked hard. We were a very ethical company. We were the highest rated mortgage banking company by the rating agencies in the country. with the highest rated servicing operation in the country by Fannie, Freddie, Ginny, FHA, S&P, because we worked hard, and we were passionate, and we were ethical. There's not much of it. If you say, what, you know, if I had a magic wand, I would have sold the Bank of America in 2006. That's what I would have done. Yeah. There's nothing in trade. Look, we're human beings. We're 60,000 people. You're going to have people, you know, three continents, get people make mistakes, honest mistakes. But none of material, none of them crucial, none of them. I can't point to anyone that anybody did that caused any material problems in the country. It was an environment. Our oxygen was cut off, as was Lehman, AIG, everybody. Just the oxygen shut off, just like it was shut off in this room. Somebody could say, you know, to your kids down the line, well, why was he sitting there? You didn't know the oxygen was shut off. Mm-hmm. Would you have done something different? Yeah, you wouldn't have come here. You know, the oxygen was going to come off. You wouldn't have seen this room.
Good stuff. I'm going to assure them that we're not turning the oxygen.
Well, you don't know. It's up to God.
That'll impact all of us.
It's the air conditioner, right?
So let me try to follow up a little on that, and I appreciate the response, but mistakes made, lesson learned. Follow up. I mean, looking back, any opinions on whether or not, for example, the funding structure of the company maybe should have been different? Any opinions on whether or not the growth of the company should have been different? Any opinions on, you know, the size of the origination warehouse, or the quality or composition of the loan portfolio on the bank books? I mean, those are the kind of specific things that I'm wondering if you have any opinions about.
At the time, I think we did everything within the bounds of our intellectual capabilities, our core competencies, our financial strength, our organizational structure, our growth pattern, was all within the realm of me having a high degree of confidence in our ability to continue operating the company in a sustainable way, providing a good return to our shareholders.
Anybody, and let me know.
What that means. Are you looking at me? Because
you're going to be the one that's going to let me know.
Disagree now without even
knowing the question. Let's talk a little bit about risk management at Countrywide. How was the risk management function structured, and specifically, who did the chief risk officer report to?
That's okay. You doing good?
The chief risk
officer. I was hoping that I could interject before David did with the warm up, and then it's that question. It's like, okay, go ahead.
To my the best of my recollection, the chief risk officer reported to the chief credit officer, and chief risk officer reported to the chief operations officer and the president of the company.
Okay. And was there a risk committee of the board of directors?
There was.
Okay. And I take it you were on that committee?
I was not on any committee.
I'm sorry, you were not on any committee?
On any committee.
Okay. Okay. Anybody, do you recall, and particularly in probably the second half 2006?
They kept that committee independent.
Right, right. So in the 2006-2007 time frame, do you recall whether or not anybody in the risk management function was expressing concerns about any parts of the company and recommending the company do things differently?
That's right at the heart.
Okay, let's go off the record for a minute.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, in other words, while we were